This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A broken bridge causes yet another commuter mess. A landmark police discrimination case closes yet another chapter. And Charlie Hustle is back in baseball, and he's coming right back here to Bridgeport. Those are just a few of the stories we'll be covering today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. As always, you can join us with your thoughts on the week's news, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email us wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra was speaking on WFSB's Face the State over the weekend, broadly explaining why and how he made the decision to bring minor league baseball to the city of Hartford.
Well, I believe that the studies that our consultants put forward, this wasn't a decision that I just summarily did on my own. I depended a lot on the advice from consultants and professionals in this area who have done this in other states. One of the report cites that we're one of the best markets in order to be able to sustain such a team in our city.
Such a team is the AA baseball minor league Rockcats, who currently reside in New Britain, Connecticut. Now, earlier this week on the Colin McEnroe Show, sports economics professor Andrew Zimblis from Smith College said those consultants usually paint a pretty rosy picture of these things.
I think universally, for every single minor league, major league, and college stadium that's been built over the last 30 years, there's a consultant group that's hired. They do an input-output study, uses a model that's usually called REMI, R-E-M-I. That methodology is inappropriate for this purpose, and they make unrealistic assumptions.
So today in the program, we're going to talk a little bit about what these consultants have told the city of Hartford and what we know about the government process that may be bringing minor league baseball to the city. Our guest, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Mark Pazniokas is also here. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Good morning, Paz.
Good morning to you.
And Jeff Cohen is WNPR's reporter who's been covering this story. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Hi, John.
Maybe you can just talk us through a little bit about what we know about this deal so far, Jeff.
Sure. Well, we know a lot as of last week, and as we'll hear later, we didn't learn a whole lot before last week. This was a process that was done for the better part of a year and a half confidentially, and we'll get an explanation from that coming up. I think it is a plan that Mayor Segarra is very proud of. It's one that he thinks could make a big difference in the north end of Hartford, a part of the city that is historically separated from the rest of the city by I-84 when it's sort of cut off.
It's physically separated and has been for decades.
So we've been looking – the city has been looking for a long time for good ideas on how to bridge that gap and grow – you know, grow development. Maybe that means grow downtown into the northern part of the city or grow the northern part of the city into downtown and bring some development to where, frankly, there are a lot of vacant surface parking lots. The issue that we've seen, though, is that some of the projections that we have seen have been kind of rosy. The economic underpinnings of this whole thing are based on the idea that 500,000 people a year will come to the baseball games alone. That's 7,000 people a game. That's higher than any average in the Eastern League. That's nearly double, or it's the Rockettes only get 3,800 on average as it is now. So those are ambitious numbers. They lead to ambitious economic conclusions and suggestions on how much the city and the state will benefit from it. So what's happened now is that people have started to question the plan, as they should, or as is normal. And there are supporters and there are detractors, and now that's being discussed in public.
Colin McEnroe, I know you've been writing a lot about this. You've had some time to digest, and you've talked with people like Andrew Zimblis about this deal. What are you thinking right now about this proposal?
I guess what I'm thinking is that every day seems to disgorge a whole new question or two, and most of the questions are things that really, really need to be examined with some zeal. I mean, for example, today the Hartford Courant has produced or analyzed 300 emails back and forth between the city and the owners of the Rockcats. So one of the things that jumped out at me is that at many of the meetings with city officials, sometimes the only person present from the Rockcats with city officials is a man named Art Solomon. Now, Art Solomon is the parent, he's the father of the three siblings who allegedly, or at least on paper, own the Rockcats. Art Solomon owns the New Haven Fisher Cats and several other minor league baseball teams, or at least one other minor league baseball team. But the New Haven Fisher Cats are very relevant because you're not allowed to own more than one team in the Eastern League. So, I mean, when in fact this particular partnership entered into the Eastern League, they had to assure the Eastern League that they were absolutely separate from the entity that owns the New Haven Fisher Cats, which used to be the New Haven Ravens, but that's another story. And so it does appear that if Art Solomon is representing the team, and sometimes the only person representing the team in an encounter with city officials, he seems to be playing a much more significant role with the New Britain Rock Cats than the role he's supposed to play, which is no role at all.
And you've been talking, Jeff, to various people who are close to this deal or maybe just finding out about this deal within the last week as we have. What have they been telling you?
Well, that's right. And, you know, the mayor by design had to keep this conversation fairly close to the vest because he didn't, in his mind, didn't want to spoil the deal with the Rock Cats. The problem is that left some people out of the loop, including some people who are running for office, like Senator Eric Coleman, who we spoke with yesterday.
I couldn't support this proposal as it is, and I just hope that we're not at a point where folks in Hartford are so desperate that they're willing to grasp at anything in hopes that it will work.
And so then we continued speaking further about the idea of how this was not presented to the public in order to maintain the viability of the deal, and he had some thoughts about that also.
I'm not certain why for 16, 17, 18 months somebody from City Hall would have been working on this proposal without drawing in some of the stakeholders or even some of the key people in City Hall.
So we want to bring into the conversation someone from City Hall. He's Tom Deller. He's Director of Development Services for the City of Hartford. He's joined us in the program before. Tom, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
So first question, in terms of this process, why did we have to keep this process out of public view? Why was it important for 16, 17, 18 months, as Eric Coleman puts it, for us to not really know that this deal was going down?
I think, you know, you need to understand that we do development deals every day. We work with developers all the time. And there's a lot of discussion that goes on that happens before anything goes public. We need the ability to do our job, to sit down, to vet a project, to understand, does it make sense? Does it fit into a variety of regulations? What are the background information that may help us understand that this is something that we should consider? And to really sit down and look at similar things around the country. So, you know, this is daily operating procedure. This is the way we do our job. I mean, I have several meetings today with developers talking about things, and until we have a concept of where they're going and what they're doing, we don't go public with it.
Hey, Tom, it's Jeff Cohen. Just a question to that point. Procedurally, we know that the city – there is this report by a sports consultant.
Uh-huh.
Normally, if the city wants to hire a consultant, the city hires a consultant. In this configuration, the city hired an attorney to be its counsel as it explored this matter, and then that attorney then went ahead and hired the consultant. Why'd you do it that way?
We've done it that way in the past for other things. It's a way to get things done, procure things, and move things forward. It's a normal practice that we have used a few times. It's just a way to keep things moving forward and get it done in a timely manner. We require that when we do that, the firm that's doing the hiring for us meet the city's requirements of getting at least three proposals and do the analysis to meet all the city procurement rules. But it's a way to keep projects moving given the demands that we have on our staff at times.
But Tom, does it satisfy – this is going to get technical, but does it satisfy the city's procurement rules if a third party, like a lawyer, is procuring the contract for you? It would seem that if the contract is more than $25,000, then the city itself needs to be bidding that out.
Well, I think it meets the procurement rules. I think we've had that discussion before we did it, and I think it does.
Okay. Let me ask then, and then I'll be done, on the confidentiality side. Could you explain a little bit on what you heard, though, from the Rock Cats? Because we've heard that the Rock Cats needed this secret. We know that the Rock Cats, you've said that they would leave the state of Connecticut. Did you come to an analysis that their representation was merited or warranted, that you actually risked losing the deal if word leaked out?
We had a lot of discussions with Josh Solomon and his attorney, who I'm blocking on his name right now, as well as the president of the Eastern League, who were very clear that they needed confidentiality so that they would not damage their brand, their name, and that they, if they couldn't figure out a way to stay in Connecticut, other than New Britain, that they would end up moving. And, you know, we did a lot of discussion on that. We did a lot of research. We talked a lot. You know, that we have a state that's sort of west part of the state is controlled by the Mets and the Yankees. The east part of the state is controlled by the Red Sox. There's this very small column in the center part of the state where they can be located. And there's really probably there's not many places they can go. So based on our discussions and based on the checking we did, we believed that that had to be kept confidential, just like a lot of development deals are.
We're talking with Tom Deller. He's Director of Development Services for the City of Hartford. We're in the wheelhouse today on Where We Live with Jeff Cohen, Mark Pazniokas, and Colin McEnroe. Colin?
Yeah, Mr. Deller, you said just now that you do – the city does deals like this all the time and that you have meetings today of deals like this. How often does the city put $50 million or more of public money into one of these deals?
Colin, we don't often put public money, that scope of money, in public deals.
I mean, have you ever been involved in a deal before in which the city of Hartford has put $50 million or more?
The most we put into a deal was $5 million into the Colt facility.
So this isn't really like deals that you do every day, right?
When you're talking about the dollar amount, no. But the types of negotiations that go on is really something that we have a lot of discussion about with developers. We sit down and we talk with developers about how we're investing in what we're doing. You know, whether it's some of the housing deals, you know, 3 Constitution Plaza, where we've invested, the city's investing about $1 million, or 390 Capitol Avenue, the old Hartford Supply Building, we're investing a little over $3 million. You know, those are discussions that go on, and we have very confidential discussions with the developer and then take it to the mayor and the city council. And then when we have agreement that there's a basic sense that we're going to make this investment and move forward, then we go public with it. I mean, those things happen. And this is a different in nature because it's building a stadium, a city facility that the city will own. It will be a city asset. The team will be responsible for maintaining it and managing it. But it'll be a city asset, just like Bushnell Park's a city asset, just like other facilities that we've built, schools and others are city assets. This is a city asset that we're building, that we're having someone operate to bring some life to the north end of the city.
Just because these negotiations were held in private, obviously we're all playing a lot of catch up right now. We're trying to figure out how things happen. So in the current today, these emails that were released, it's clear that at one point you were in meetings with the team and its lawyers about a stadium that would cost $32 million. So how did the price of the stadium get doubled? Why is it a $60 million stadium now when it was $32 at one point in the meetings with these other principals?
$32 million was the price for the development of a stadium that had happened about 5 or 6 years ago. I don't remember exactly what stadium it was. What we have done, and in an effort to try to understand, the $60 million is a little on the high side. We actually went out and had, after we analyzed a variety of sites in the city as potential sites, we picked one that we felt was best for the city to achieve things. We had a preliminary analysis done of the cost of constructing this facility and ancillary costs. The rough number that we had, looking at my notes here, I think was about $52 million or $51 million. I'm trying to find the page that has those numbers on it. We talked about a few other things that have to be done, road relocation and things of that nature, and put a rough budget number of $60 million out there. Our goal is to spend as only what we have to, nothing extra. But that was the analysis that was done, and that's how the numbers came together.
Mark Pazniokas has a question for you. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, Tom, an element of this has been how real is the threat by the Rockettes to leave the state? So in your discussions with the team, what were the factors they cited for driving them out of New Britain, where to the outside eye, it seems to be a decent deal? It's a much lower rent than they'll pay in Hartford. It's about $100,000 a year. Their attendance by Eastern League standards is strong. They are in a relatively modern stadium that was built in 1996. So what's the problem down there?
I think a couple of points came out. One is the way the lease is established, the way it works, is the city has full liability and responsibility for maintenance. And preparing the fields and everything else. And there's been some, what they've said to me, there have been some issues with that. Two is, as they're looking at what's happening in Eastern League and how stadiums are being designed and marketed, they're looking at the trying to build their team to make it a bigger, more attractive sport, to bring more people in. And so it's a business deal that they're looking at, and they're trying to understand how to get a return on their investment of, I think, what they spent about $16 million buying the team. So they're looking at options. When they approached us, they were saying that They're trying to analyze what to do and where to go, and they were interested in talking to us about it. And as I said, we talked to the president of the Eastern League and got some understanding from him and felt that they weren't going to stay in New Britain, and we had to do something to keep them in Connecticut.
We've got a couple minutes left with Tom Deller from the city of Hartford as we're talking about the deal to bring minor league baseball to the city. We're talking in the wheelhouse with Jeff Cohen and Colin McEnroe and Mark Pazniokas. Paz, I just have a question for you. One of the storylines around this entire thing has been that Governor Malloy has essentially distanced himself from this entire deal. A previous governor, Governor Rowland, was very big into redeveloping urban areas, as we well know, including Hartford. We heard earlier that Eric Coleman, others in the state legislature, maybe don't know anything about what's going on here. What do you think the impact is of the city keeping this from folks at the state level?
Well, the political necessity dictated the governor takes the position he's had, and I think the governor is relieved to be outside this process to a large degree. When there have been other efforts by governors to move sports franchises, it's been from outside the state. You know, this obviously is a very ticklish situation where a Democratic governor, the last place he wants to be is standing between Hartford and New Britain during a fight over a sports franchise.
Well, and I think that that's one of the questions I had for you, Tom Deller. Obviously, you folks do an awful lot of business with the city. You're in constant contact with them around development deals, including their very active DECD. I'm wondering if you feel that cutting this deal is going to be worth it, given the fact that with the state government not part of this process, the governor essentially distancing himself from it, it may be very well harder for you to go to the city to ask for money for some of the services that you've needed to ask for money for in the past, or to even get involved in a big development deal like this, given the fact that you struck out on your own on this one.
I don't think so. I think that, you know, we work with the state on a variety of issues. Every day, every week, we meet with people. We talk whether it's DECD, housing, others. You know, we work together, and I don't think that, you know, if a city or town in Connecticut does something on their own without the state, that doesn't say that the state's not going to work with them on other deals. Everybody, almost every community, does something on their own without necessarily involving the state. So why should this impact any future deals that we work with?
Well, I think just getting back to Colin McEnroe's point, that this is a much bigger deal than a lot of the deals we're talking about.
No, I was just going to say the governor is threading that very needle. He has also made it clear that he does not consider this a breach of his relationship with Mayor Segarra.
We're taking some of your tweets and emails, and we'll get to those in a second. We have a call coming in here from Larry Deutsch. He's a Hartford City Councilman. Hello, Larry.
Well, hello. Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, on our mind is this, that as you've already said, The city council and other city officials were left out of the discussion, which I do think is a mistake, recognizing even the discussion about confidentiality and so on. On the other hand, transparency has been absent, as you've already said. But I do think that city council, or some of us at least, should have been discussed, because we may have different priorities. First and foremost is jobs for Hartford residents and others, and sometimes some parties may not consider that as important. And we're speaking about claims many people in the city feel. I speak as minority leader, but I think for the majority of Hartford citizens, that the assurances of 655 jobs, full-time equivalent, so on, seems patently false unless you surmise all the ancillary stuff. So there are a lot of assumptions made that many people in the city object to, and likewise the financing, that solely Hartford financing it rather than either venture capitalists, CERTA, whatever corporation wants naming rights. So I would say that your panel, all of us in conversation, will not let it go through unless certain questions are answered. That's the biggest thing about jobs with duration and quality and good salaries and financing, which is involves other parties than the city of Hartford taxpayers.
And I think we're trying to get answers to some of those questions. Jeff, you want to jump in?
Well, so I think what Councilman Deutsch is getting to is the idea that the city council and the mayor now are now at a point of setting priorities. And this is where the discussion is now. Is this the right priority at the right time for the city? Is a baseball stadium? We know just weeks ago the mayor was at the state capitol asking for money to help close his budget. We know that he was looking to sell parking garages, sell city assets to make his annual budget, operating budget work. Now the city is going to go out and it has the resources to borrow and pay the debt service on $60 million potentially. The discussion now is, well, is this the priority for now? Some things that are on the capital improvement project list will have to come off of the capital improvement project list. And that's now where the discussion is. What's going to be lost if we do this stadium?
And Tom Teller, I'll just give you a last word and ask you to answer that. What happens to all these other projects, and what happens to the fact that the city has had to borrow to just make ends meet recently? How do we reconcile these two things?
Well, I think there are some projects in the capital budget that may be delayed, but we are going through every project and identifying projects that are completed and have spare cash, projects that are not moving forward for a variety of reasons because we no longer are going to do it. Something was budgeted 3 or 4 years ago, was decided not to do it, and we have identified a series of dollars, somewhere between $15 and $25 million, that we're going to sit down with the mayor and the council and discuss and say, this is the reason that we're going to eliminate these, or we don't think we need them now, or these are spare dollars that have come back to the city because we didn't need them for the project. So there's that amount of money. We've worked very hard this year in looking at the capital budget and looking at the capital budget moving forward and the things that we need. And the budget that was submitted to the council, and I believe the council approved it this past week for the capital budget, is very clear on addressing the needs of the city as it becomes to roads and schools and other things. We're very cognizant of what we can afford to do given what our bond rating has done, what our financial advisors have told us. And we've created an internal cap of what we will not exceed and where we're going. So I think that what's important, though, is to think about the fact that this is not about what Hartford was, but what Hartford's going to become. And we need to stop being negative and understand that we need to discuss these priorities and figure out the best way to move forward and what to achieve it, how to achieve it. And that is the policy debate that happens between the mayor and the council. It is before the council at this point. We will continue to have these discussions. And to follow up on what Councilman Deutsch said, we are intent in creating as many jobs for the city residents as possible.
I think it's just – and I know, Colin, you probably want to jump in on this because we have to – end the segment, but it's a policy debate that is happening between the mayor and the city council, perhaps, but a policy debate that I know you'd probably like to see happen in the public more, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, now, of course, we want to know what those $15 to $25 million in expenditures that are now fungible are. And I mean, I really do think that at a certain point, the way that this is being discussed becomes a little like through the looking glass. I mean, on the one hand, you're going to the state and asking for money to close a hole in your budget, and now you're announcing that there's somewhere between $15 and $25 million that you can pull out of the budget because there's money left over after projects, or there's a project you don't want to do, or something like that.
Not the budget, Colin, the capital budget.
The capital budget. Nonetheless, I mean, on the one hand, you can't cry poor mouth and then suddenly say, well, really, actually, we've got $15 to $25 million that we could put into play right now just by, squeezing some things out of this project and maybe delaying that project. I don't think that was the song that was being sung up at the state capitol.
Well, there's a huge difference between how we fund a capital budget and how we fund an operating budget. And the capital budget line item is a debt service line item in the budget, and that's a fairly small line item this year. And we did squeeze that, and we did reduce that. This is talking about dollars that have been allocated, dollars that have been that floated, funds that are available that we can only use for capital items, and that's how we're going to use them.
Tom Deller is Director of Development Services for the City of Hartford. Tom, as always, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too. This is The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're going to move on to some other topics, including, well, we're spending money on ballparks. Maybe we're not spending money on a bridge that should be fixed. As we head into a break, I'll get a couple tweets from Josh. How often does the city invest $50 million in a development it knows will be revenue negative? Shonzo asks, a new city asset? Has anyone looked at how poorly Keeney and Goodwin Park golf courses were taken care of as city assets? And Josh tweets us, why do we even care if the Rockettes leave the state? Here's one more from Josh. Albany Avenue, Farmington Avenue, Wethersfield Avenue are not completed unless the city wants to attract off-road enthusiasts. You can keep the tweets coming at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Coming up, we'll discuss some recent developments in the race for lieutenant governor and the end of a chapter in East Haven. Our guest, as always, in studio, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on the show today, Colin?
Oh, we're going to talk about the plight of young black men, the ways in which young black men seem especially and disproportionately vulnerable for everything from poverty to incarceration. And we're going to link it to Ta-Nehisi Coates' landmark 15,000-word piece in The Atlantic a few weeks ago about the question of reparations and about whether the case for reparations extends far beyond the end of the Civil War and into other kinds of policy decisions that continue to create structural disadvantages.
That's a really big conversation coming up 1 o'clock today, The Colin McEnroe Show. Also joining us, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Now, last week, a swing bridge in Norwalk was stuck open. It's the second time in 2 weeks the bridge has disrupted Metro North traffic, and it adds to a string of problems for the commuter rail line. Here is Senator Richard Blumenthal speaking about the bridge problems earlier this week.
The outcry of outrage reflects not just inconvenience, but economic catastrophe caused by the outage of this bridge.
Now, when we say this bridge, it's called the Walk Bridge. It's in Norwalk. And, Colin, this bridge isn't, like, new or anything. This bridge has been around for a while.
Yeah, the bridge was built in 1896 when Grover Cleveland was president of the United States. So the good news is I think we got our money's worth. another way to think about this is when this bridge was built, it was built the same year that train tracks first reached Miami for the first time, Miami, Florida. Miami, Florida was not incorporated at the time. It became incorporated because rail service reached there. So during the entire existence of Miami, Florida, because train travel, passenger trains finally reached it, we have had this bridge.
That is kind of an amazing little piece of history, paving the way for LeBron James to go to South Beach. Let's go to Jim Cameron. He's from the Commuter Action Group. He is our rail watcher, and he's been following this as closely as anyone and writing about it, of course. Jim, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, guys.
That little bit of train history, it's funny in a way, Jim, but it's not funny when we've got a 100-year-old bridge that's stuck open a couple times in just the last week. First of all, I just have to ask, what's going on with this bridge, and is this something that we've known about but just not fixed?
Oh, this is nothing new. I mean, it's been a couple of times in the past week that it's been stuck in an open position, swung open to accommodate river traffic but couldn't get closed. But they've had those problems on that bridge going back many years. So as Colin said, we got our money out of this bridge. Somebody should have started designing it to replace this bridge decades ago so we wouldn't have this problem. And by the way, this is just one of about five or six crucial bridges, some of which are younger, only built in 1902, but they need to be replaced as well, too.
So new bridges.
Any one of these bridges that has problems is the weakest link in the chain that is the Northeast Corridor. No Amtrak, no Metro North service. These bridges should have been planned to be replaced decades ago. I think it is egregious that the governor on Friday is screaming bloody murder about how outrageous it is that Metro North is not maintaining this bridge, and then Monday morning going down to talk to the MTA officials and discovering, oops, it's our bridge, it's Connecticut's bridge, it's our responsibility.
So it is Connecticut's responsibility, meaning it's our responsibility to have done something over time. Quickly, Mark Pazniokas, what is the governor saying about this now? I mean, so we've got a bridge that clearly needs to be replaced. Nobody's done anything about it for the last couple decades. Are we going to get any money to fix it now?
That's a bit of a long shot, I'd say. The funds they're seeking are Sandy funds. These are called resiliency projects. In other words, even if the bridge wasn't damaged by Sandy, if you can make the case that investing federal funds may prevent future storm damage, you have a shot at these funds. And they're looking for quite a bit of money. It's north of $300 million for the federal share. The problem is these are very competitive, and they're looking for a big, big chunk. And it's something that, as Jim Cameron quite accurately said, it's something the state has deferred for decades. There are a lot of dirty hands on this. It goes back a long, long time.
Jim, why has the state deferred so much on this? Obviously, it costs money to repair bridges, to be clear. But you've been saying for years, a lot of people have been saying for years, this is the most ridden, the most important rail corridor in the entire United States, the most important part of the most important country in the world, and we don't seem to want to fix anything. Why is it taken so long?
Well, we don't have enough money for all the priorities that the state has. And obviously, the money would not be spent on something that hasn't failed yet. I mean, remember 30 years ago, it took the collapse of the Mayanus River Bridge on I-95 to draw attention to the deferred maintenance of bridges. Well, we're going through the same thing now. I mean, the expression in Hartford is, how far can you kick the can down the street? Well, we've kicked this can 117, 118 years down the street, and now it's starting to fail. And now it's like, okay, attention, Hartford, we have a problem. Yes. We should have known we'd have this problem. Congratulations for the governor to try to turn lemon into lemonade by looking for relief from the superstorm Sandy. I don't know why the feds would want to reward us for deferred maintenance by giving us money that's supposed to be used to repair damage from the superstorm, to be used to really catch up on our own neglect of maintenance of a bridge that we should have replaced decades ago.
We're talking with Jim Cameron, who's a commuter advocate who's been writing about and covering Metro North for years, and with us here on The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. Just the last thing for you, Jim, and I think this is important. We've long talked about the fact that these bridges, the ones that have to swing open or raise open to allow boats to pass through, the trains, which are very important, are at the whims of boaters, who are also very important. But I was shocked to learn just how often this bridge has to be used. I thought maybe it got raised and lowered or swung around maybe four or five times a day, but it was around 270 times over the course of 1 year, meaning that less than every day somebody has to use this bridge. Why don't we just fix these bridges that aren't going to work in a closed position and say, boaters, you got to go elsewhere because these trains have got to get through?
Well, I mean, that's what Blumenthal is proposing at this moment, and he's using his clout on the Senate Commerce Committee to persuade the Coast Guard to keep that bridge closed until absolutely necessary. But let's remember, this is not just a bunch of people that decided to get into a sailboat Friday afternoon and force that bridge to open and then disrupt traffic. There is serious commercial barge traffic that goes up the Norwalk River, including heating oil barges. So in the winter, it might be hard to argue that we have to keep that bridge closed if it's going to mean freezing people out of their homes in Norwalk.
And they already
this is serious commerce that happens in this river, too.
A pass.
And to Senator Blumenthal's point, the Coast Guard already has granted the DOT an exemption. Under general rules, every time a boat comes, you got to raise the bridge. But in this case, the Coast Guard has already said, no. During basically rush hour, you don't have to play by that rule. So they've already, I think, done probably what they can.
I think we should get resiliency money because this bridge may still be trying to bounce back from the Spanish-American War. But in some ways, this is the perfect symbol of Connecticut's incredible myopia about mass transit, right?
We have
a commuter rail line here that really not only is it – I mean, this is a very unsafe situation. I don't know if anybody said that so far. But this strikes me as an incredibly unsafe situation. And we know that Metro North has been riddled with unsafe situations. It no longer really approaches the standards for safety of a rail line. It's closer to like one of those amusement parks that sets up in your town for about a week and the Tilt-A-Whirl's run by some 17-year-old kid who smokes pot all day long. You're probably safer on that than you are on one of these trains at this point. But beyond that, you know, a mass transit system that doesn't get upgraded for 100 years or more is also the same mass transit system that doesn't build any new mass transit. I mean, people are convulsing about the busway now, the New Britain-Hartford busway, like some horrible, demonic thing is happening. We're finally actually building some new mass transit. We need to build more mass transit, and obviously we need to maintain the mass transit that we have at a level above the Victorian era in which it was built.
And the busway is going to be very important to get those minor league baseball fans from New Britain into the city of Hartford.
Maybe the linchpin.
In a couple of years.
Yeah.
Jim, how big a factor is the tangled history of basically Metro North? You had, you know, a failed railroad in the 60s, and then it morphed into this. To what extent is what we're seeing today a legacy of that?
Well, I think that raises a very important point. Let's remember that these tracks, these bridges, these overhead power wires in Connecticut are owned by the state of Connecticut. They're not owned by Metro North. They're not owned by Amtrak. This is the legacy of the creation of the MTA 30 years ago. So it's good news. We own these, but with that ownership comes the responsibility of maintaining them. So I've even gone so far as to suggest, why don't we sell these tracks, these bridges, and the cost of replacing them to the federal government? Why don't we let Amtrak own this section of track like they own every other section of track in the Northeast Corridor? There's no particular advantage that we have in maintaining the ownership of these, especially if we don't have the money to maintain them.
Jim Cameron is founder of the Commuter Action Group. He covers commuter issues along the shoreline better than just about anyone, and he joined us once again today on Where We Live. Jim, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
When we come back from our break, we're going to move to a new chapter in East Haven. It's announced that it's agreed to settle a federal civil rights lawsuit involving its police department. Diane Orson's been covering that story for us. She'll be here to talk about it, Where We Live, right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, Tom Foley won his party's endorsement, and recent Quinnipiac polls show him neck and neck with Governor Dana Malloy in a rematch of the contest 4 years ago. Tom Foley will be back in studio for another round of Where We Vote, where you get a chance to ask questions of the candidates. Hope you can join us tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We take a look at the week's news with Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and joining us now is Diane Orson, who's WNPR's managing editor and Morning Edition host. Good morning, Diane. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John.
On Monday, the town of East Haven announced it has agreed to settle the federal civil rights lawsuit involving its police department. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what happened this week.
Well, basically, this is what I describe as one of three parts, three responses to the initial allegations of police brutality and abuse by East Haven police. So what happened was about 5.5 years ago, Latino business owners and residents began speaking out about intimidation and harassment. And Yale Law School interns began gathering their stories and filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, which launched an investigation. And I would call that part one. And they, in 2011, announced that their probe had found that the East Haven Police Department did, in fact, engage in a pattern of discriminatory policing. Part two, which was settled this week, I would call it, is when Father Manship and other plaintiffs filed a civil rights complaint. But that had been put on hold because of part three, which was the criminal case. And the criminal case, as you may recall, involved eventually the FBI arresting four East Haven police officers. And now that that has been completed, the civil case reopened, and that's what was settled this week.
So maybe you can tell us about what's in the settlement.
The first part is that East Haven has agreed to pay $450,000 to the nine plaintiffs who filed the case. Let's take a listen to a piece of tape here. Here's attorney David Rosen, one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs, explaining another piece of this agreement.
The town of East Haven, in a legal agreement, has gotten itself out of the business of being a border patrol and has gotten itself full-time into the business of having its police department be a law enforcement agency enforcing the criminal laws of the United States, the state of Connecticut, which is its mission.
He's referring to changes in the way East Haven police will enforce civil immigration laws. I mean, Connecticut actually already has pretty restricted policies on the way police can inquire about immigration status, for example, during routine police operations. But East Haven police now say that they'll go even further and they'll totally separate their policing functions from civil immigration enforcement.
We also heard from East Haven Mayor Joseph Maturo. He has been, to say the least, very controversial throughout this entire process. He's been the center of attention. He's made some inappropriate comments, I think everyone would say, about the Latino population of his town. Now that this seems to be over, all three parts, as you've laid out, seems to have passed, what is he saying?
Well, basically, the town has stressed three things. First of all, this agreement contains no admission of liability or wrongdoing on the part of East Haven, so he has made a point of stressing that. By settling, both sides are saving tons of money in future, you know, possible litigation costs and legal fees. And finally, Mayor Maturo is saying that this will draw to a close a really painful chapter in East Haven history.
Do we have some tape from Justice Maturo?
Our third piece of tape, yeah.
Let's listen.
I'm just happy that the settlement is closed, and I think we're on to bigger and better things within our community.
Okay, so they are the folks of East Haven on to bigger and better things? I mean, is this over, Diane?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the legal battles are over. East Haven remains under U.S. Justice Department oversight. And yesterday's agreement in terms of East Haven's policing of immigration matters continues for 5 years.
Colin McEnroe, lessons learned from this entire chapter, do you think?
One lesson is that this was resolved before the resolution of Mayor Maturo's firefighter pension, which I apparently will outlive this case. He's drawing a firefighter disability pension while he's being mayor. That's also somewhat controversial. I think that, but the more important lesson is, or the more important question is, one of accountability. You know, and it's something that runs through a lot of our conversations today. How do you make public officials accountable for things that ultimately damage the city? You know, if this baseball stadium is not a big success, most of the people associated with it will be long gone by the time that becomes apparent to all of us. The other thing that happens, though, is there are disasters which don't seem to cost people their elective office. I mean, this is a really bad situation. I think they got out of it kind of cheap at $450,000, but this was a very bad situation on every possible level. It did nothing to injure Mayor Maturo's political standing in East Haven. So you kind of wonder, how do you create accountability in these kinds of situations? And I wish I had a brilliant answer to that.
Well, and what you also need is a change in culture. And that requires leadership that is not going to sign this settlement through gritted teeth. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, Mayor Maturo did so that way. But to me, the big unresolved question in East Haven, is there the organic leadership that is now going to step up and say, this is not how we want to police, this is not how we want to treat minorities, and will that change be embraced by the East Haven Police Department?
And it's really – organic is the key word, Paz. It's not just about what is part of a settlement. It's about what do people really want to do. What sort of a town, a city do we want to have? And Diane, I know you've been thinking a lot about this. You've been covering this story for years.
Well, I must comment. It was notable to me that there was no apology made, you know, in the course of this. As somebody who was in the original group of reporters 5.5 years ago who were in the basement of St. Rose of Lima Church when these Latino business owners and residents very courageously, frankly, spoke out. And, you know, some of these people had bricks thrown through their windows for speaking out. They were really harassed. You know, unjust things happen in the world all the time, and a lot of times we don't know about it. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see if there is actually a change in this sort of culture of intolerance in East Haven. But to be fair, to a large extent, justice was served, and East Haven is being dragged kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
Diane Orson is the managing editor of WNPR, and she's our Morning Edition host as well. She's been covering this story for years. Diane, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to move on quickly to a few political issues and one baseball-related issue. There's been some talk, Paz, this week about a few running mates. One running mate is Mark Bouton's running mate, Mark Loretti, the other mayor, looking to get enough votes to qualify for public financing. How's that going?
We won't know for probably 10 days. They filed their petitions last night at 4. At least they tried. In at least one small town, they discovered that City Hall was – or Town Hall was closed, and they couldn't file their petitions in Bridgewater, Connecticut.
Oh.
Yeah. So, this really is vital to Mark Bouton's campaign for governor. He needs Mark Loretti to qualify for the – primary ballot, and the reason is he needs Mark Loretti as a fundraising partner to qualify for public financing. No public financing, no Mark Bouton campaign.
You know, and Heather Bond Summers is the lieutenant governor candidate who deserted Mark Bouton after what appeared to be an early combining of their forces. She raises kind of an interesting point, actually. She says at a certain point it occurred to her – I don't know why it didn't occur to her earlier – that she wouldn't really have her own money. You know, she ultimately – she'd be pooling her money with Mark Bouton under this kind of arrangement. And she suggested in past – I don't know the answer to this question – that was maybe never even contemplated as the CEP, the Citizens Elect program, was set up. The notion that ultimately to qualify for public financing, what one could do was take one's gubernatorial money and combine it with one's running mate money to qualify to hit one mark.
Connecticut is of two minds when it comes to running for governor and lieutenant governor. In the fall, you vote once. There's a team. In a primary, you get to pick one from column A, one from column B. On the campaign finance stuff, you can do it one of two ways. The lieutenant governor can go get her or his own grant. Candidate for governor can get his own grant, or not as a result of a clear state law, but as a result of a state elections enforcement commission ruling 4 years ago, or you can pool them. That's what Mike Fedeli and a guy named Mark Boughton did when they ran together 4 years ago. So it's kind of a muddled picture. It would be nice if the legislature would provide some clarity. You know, should you be able to run separately in primary for governor and lieutenant governor as opposed to being, you know, being introduced to somebody on election night, you know, in kind of a shotgun marriage? It's probably not good politics.
If you look at the way the program's set up, I think it's pretty clear that you shouldn't be able to do this.
Well, let's talk about another running mate, Jonathan Pelto, who it seems very likely now is about to stage a third-party candidacy for governor, which could really throw a fly in the ointment of the Malloy campaign. He picked a running mate this week, Colin. Ebony Murphy, someone who's appeared on our program before, a teacher, a blogger, somebody like John Pelto, very outspoken about what education is these days.
There's something about this ticket that says screams 21st century to me. You know, I mean, the fact that she's an African-American woman running mate. I mean, you know, I never expected to be such a Jonathan Pelto fan in my life. But in so many ways, this ticket is starting to call attention not so much to itself, but to deficiencies in this calcified existing political process of the other two parties.
That ticket screams to me single-issue campaign.
Well, two.
Well, it's single-issue campaign, and the single issue is education reform.
Right.
Well, Jonathan Pelto has said just this week, you know, if he's elected governor, he would repeal the Common Core. That's the big cry from an awful lot of people in the education field. Sometimes single-issue candidates, and we'll just remember Ned Lamont here, you can run an awful long way on a single issue, and if what you're really trying to do is turn over a new chapter in the way the Democratic Party works, it seems like Jonathan Pelto has a single issue that people might listen to.
And it helps to have $20 million in your pocket when you run that long way.
Yes, it does. And I understand what you're saying. But again, as a third-party candidate, this is a little something different.
Joe Visconti, who's petitioning from the right, Common Core is one of his issues. So he and Jonathan may meet somewhere as they each run to the right and left.
Okay, we've just got 2 minutes left. I can't believe Pete Rose is back in baseball. He's back with the Bridgeport Bluefish for a day, Colin, and that nobody's thought of this before. This is actually a pretty good idea to get fannies in the seats.
Yeah, this is a stunt. I mean, he's still banned from baseball, from Major League Baseball. This is a stunt. He will replace the manager for one day. You know, the Bluefish are an independent franchise. They're very different from the Rockcats. They don't work for or get paid by a major league team. As a result, maybe they can do a few crazier things. They actually have been a place of second chances for such major league luminaries as Edgardo Alfonso, Jose Offerman, and the great William O. Pena. All of them kind of came through there more or less after their major league usefulness was over.
Well, one of my favorite former Pittsburgh Pirates actually spent some time. Jose Leaned in the Bridgeport Bluefish organization. I think there was a very unfortunate arrest in the middle of Bridgeport when Jose was spending time here. It is an unusual place to play baseball because it is a place of second chances. What do you think of Pete Rose getting back into baseball in Bridgeport, Paz?
Well, when I was a college student in Boston in the 70s watching the Big Red Machine play the Red Sox, Charlie Hustle meant one thing. Charlie Hustle today, I think, means something entirely else.
Well, you know, it does mean something else. It also points to, as Colin said before, the real difference between minor league baseball, the type that might come to Hartford as we bring this full circle, and the type that's happening in Bridgeport. It's a sort of a rogue thing, you know, this independent league baseball. It's a lot of fun. There's not a whole lot of rules who can play in the league and not. I mean, I don't know. This seems like it might be a good thing for the Bridgeport Bluefish to bring in Pete Rose for a day.
Couldn't hurt. It will get some people there. It will also invite a lot of jokes about, you know, whether he'll have money on the game, you know.
One fish, two fish.
Mark Basniokas is Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you so much, Baz.
My pleasure.
And rhyming Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Thank you for CTN. They came today and they pointed their cameras at all of this stuff. You can join us as always online at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.